Thanks for the warm welcome, and welcome to all of you to the New World Order. As my friend Wendy Govier, who's going to be speaking with me tomorrow night, says, it's all governments against all people. Hitler had a vision of a world rule and a thousand-year Reich, and he even had a name for it in German, Die Neue Weltordnung. It translates a new world order. And that's just exactly the same world order that George Bush, an agent of fascism and repression, one of the biggest drug dealers in the world, Mad Dog Bush, Killer Bush, I can't say enough for him, has brought with him in his now, I believe, over 10-year administration in the White House. I believe he became president March 31st, 1980, and we'll get back to that date. And if you haven't gotten the message, when the head of one of the most powerful and genocidal secret police intelligence agencies in the world, the Central Intelligence Agency, then becomes president of the most powerful and destructive nation on earth, I get the message. Wendy and I both have family roots here in Canada, and coming in on the plane, we had to fill out custom forms, and they prohibit bringing in certain things. And she said, leaned over to me and said, we might not get in with your stuff. And I said, what is it? And she said, articles from an endangered species, and pointed to my book bag. As I say in one of my talks, we're not just endangered, we're dead already, at least in their plans. And the topic that Patrick promoted this for tonight was who really runs America? And part of that answer right now is George Bush and company. And I feel, though, that there's no reason to remove Bush totally from the broader perspective of recent history and of the escalating fascism in the United States since the end of World War II. And there's really no way to make sense, I think, of Bush and his connections without going over some of that history. So I'd like to start with that, a little bit of overview of my particular worldview. But I believe in order to get what's happening, you need a scorecard, and you need an introduction to the key players and to the rules of the game. And so I'd like to start with that. It's a quick course for you fast learners. And I'd ask you to suspend judgment for a few minutes, because maybe for most of you it's a whole new context of looking at the world situation. The facts are the same, but I put them in a slightly different order, with a few extra ones that seem to have been ignored by most of the mainstream media and even much of the research community. But I think when they're in that order, you can sort it out. So I'd like to steal the target of the modern era, the space between your ears that George Orwell talked about. For a little while, the system and the schools and the television have had it a good lot longer than I have, I'm sure. And so I thought I'd start to go over that history a little bit from an article that I did some time ago to sum it up and to try to introduce these people, called Good Americans. And it's reproduced as the first article in this new collection that Patrick just put together, Judge for Yourself. I think that the problem really stems back to the successful revolution of the Soviet Union about 1917. The Romanov family was spirited out of the country with all the treasury, the money. The monarchists around the world were concerned. The White Russian counter-revolutionaries were working to put themselves back in power. Colonial powers in France and Germany and England saw the handwriting on the wall. And even the United States saw the tremendous wealth in the Soviet Union as a prize worth regaining or eventually winning. So from 1918 to 1932, that royal treasury, as well as funds that were collected from these rich monarchist families and the industrialists, led by Herbert Hoover, who spent actually more time in Europe than he did in the United States, but became president of the United States, these monies were poured into the secret rearmament of post-World War I Germany. With the specific purpose, I believe, of aiming Germany then back at Russia to take the mother country away from the Bolshevik rule. And these networks formed international relations. They had an international group known as the Solidarists, who figure out through that whole period and up into the current era. They have little different names now, but It's basically the same connection. And another major force that wanted to change the history that happened there in the Soviet Union was the Vatican, who, among other things, relied on an alleged apparition of the Virgin Mary at Fatima, who warned the Pope, supposedly, that the Tsar would fall and evil forces would come to rule. This sort of Catholic propaganda was used quite successfully later in Vietnam by Edwin Lansdale, one of the top CIA propagandists and psychological warfare experts, to try to get people to go south after the 1954 agreement to divide the country in half. These were also, within the Catholic Church, probably the most reactionary and conservative elements of that church. They had still ideas that supported the Inquisition in Spain. They were people who used flagellation as prayer. And they formed a lay order within the church known as the Opus Dei, or Works of God. And they were joined also by an even older military order in the church, a secretive group known as the Knights Hospitalliers, and more recently as the Knights of Malta. And their ultimate objective was to bring down the Soviet Union, and no method or means was too extreme. They then went about helping fascists rise to power in Spain, the Franco government, Mussolini in Italy, and Hitler in Germany. And United States firms also had financial trade and dealings. U.S. banks had dealings with the pre-World War II German emerging fascist rule, supporting them through international credit banks. But this drive, which then took us into World War II and the deaths of almost 80 million people during that period, failed at Stalingrad in 1943. Tremendous cost within the Soviet Union, 22 million in that war, 22 million dead. And they were forced at that point to realize they weren't going to win the whole of the Soviet Union back. And so plans were made in 1943 to retrench and to put their forces back together. They added to their ranks at that point the embittered revanchists of Eastern Europe, the Cold Warriors and the Klansmen here in the United States, and even worse, more fascistic elements here and around the world. I think the real secret history of World War II, yet to be told, is that it was really a war against the emergence of fascism worldwide by democratic forces. Unfortunately, they basically just held for a period and are now beginning, I think, finally to fall completely. But from 1943 on, then, we went into the escalation of this Cold War propaganda that determined the domestic and foreign policy of the United States and the paramilitary spying of that period, with the idea eventually of a final exchange, which would, given the technology, be nuclear in the future. And there was no real goal for them as important as recapturing Mother Russia into the monarchist and fascist hands. But in addition to that, they had now the added eugenicists and the fascists of the Third Reich, and their scientific racism and their genocidal technologies, who saw most of the non-white world as expendable. And the fascists at that point related to most of the world as useless eaters. And they had certain groups within that in their technology and in their social order that they considered expendable. It's not really because a cult grew up around someone named Adolf Hitler. What fascism has to do with is the concentration of wealth and a certain industrial capacity that take a society to a point where you can have an actual surplus economy, where the technology is advanced enough that should you turn the use of resources rationally to human needs, the society has a capacity with a minimum amount of work for the population, when I say minimum, about 2 weeks a year, to clothe and house and feed everyone. But that wealth, instead, is concentrated within the corporate ownership of a very, very few people, and it's not in their interest to distribute it or go for an egalitarian or surplus society, and so instead they are forced to camouflage that surplus and sink it into war preparation and other useless production. At that point of technology, the other thing that becomes expendable is labor itself. There was a sort of
famous phrase that the miners here in the United States organized around the coal miners during the 1930s, because the bosses often told them that should the mine begin to collapse, they should push the mules out first and get them out of the mine. Now, that was because mules cost money, and human beings are a little easier to replace. And it's that sort of thinking then within the bias of that society, within its racial history and its structure, that will begin to single out the people who are going to be expendable. In the classic model of the 30s, in Nazi Germany, that initially went to those who were living in institutions. And the first victims of the Holocaust were neither the ethnic groups, like the Gypsies and the Jews, nor even the radicals. The largest number first killed were the inmates of the psychiatric institutions. The World Psychiatric Congresses and the World Eugenics Congresses had many overlapping members who believed that genes, I'm not talking about designer genes as we know now, but genes somehow had something to do with what they called mental illness. And so seeing these people as non-productive, feeble-minded, they had different terms to dehumanize and degrade them, they then set up killing centers in six different locations in Germany and began to experiment with the methods of killing. And it was these psychiatrists who developed the techniques of mass death, the ovens and the gas chambers, crematoria, the other methods that they then brought to Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz and the Nazi camps. They were brought in as experts. In addition, then, to this international fascist cabal at the end of World War II, we have to add these elements, and they include a group that remained in Germany called Kameradenwehr, and two groups that spread around the world, these fascists inserting themselves into the governments of many, many countries, Die Spinne and Odessa, which is the spider in the web, and these secret webs of Nazi SS men and mass murderers who escaped any justice at the end of that war, found a home in Europe and in South America, and Southern Africa, and in an obliging United States, and also here in Canada as well. Project Paperclip was the name of one major operation that had to do with retrieving the scientists and scientific secrets and developments of the Nazi state. And they brought literally hundreds of top aerospace and munition scientists from Nazi Germany who formed the corporate leadership and the technological expertise that was necessary to set up the emerging military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about when he went out of office in 1959. They also brought Nazi experts in other areas. Kurt Blohm, the Nazi who had developed viral forms of cancer as a chemical warfare agent in Nazi Germany, was brought to Fort Detrick to help the United States form its chemical and biological warfare arsenals in the 1950s. Scientists who had done gruesome experimentation both in Japan and in Germany were either brought here or their experimentation and results were brought so that the United States could continue with that training. The Belarus Brigade was a group of by Russian and Nazi troops in Belarusia, inside the Soviet Union, working under German intelligence control and a counter-revolutionary stronghold since the period in World War I, a Nazi-infested area there, what's called Fight Russia, and almost 300 of the top government officials of that Nazi Quisling government in Belarusia during the war were brought to the United States and given important intelligence jobs in the CIA, and the OSS, and Radio Free Europe, Radio Free America, Voice of America. In addition to that, dictatorships arose in South America and throughout the world whose rhetoric of fascism and whose genocidal direction came directly from Nazi collaboration and training, paid for and organized in many cases by the United States government and CIA, who sent these Nazi torturers and killers into those countries in order to give them the technology of death. The Galen Network was a black orchestra of spies whose dealings during World War II had put the Nazi spies in bed with literally every major intelligence network in the world. MI5, MI6, and the British, American OSS, which was dependent on the British and the heavily infiltrated KGB, were all targets of Galen, General Reinhard Galen's operations east under Adolf Hitler. The evil genius Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles had begun espionage attacks on the Soviet Union all the way back to the 1920s, and $200 million of Rockefeller Mellon money was gathered by Alan Dulles to put into the hands of Reinhard Galen when he got here in 1945, and he was dressed in an Army general's uniform and dumped off at the Army Historical Division at the Pentagon. As part of his cover, he brought with him the entire Nazi intelligence files on the Eastern Sector in the Soviet Union. And the deal he cut for that money and further funding was that he would answer any question our intelligence agents wanted to know about the Soviet Union. In exchange, we wouldn't ask him any questions about how he got the answers. This individual and the 350 Nazi spies that he brought in after him formed the basis for the entire Operation Division of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947. These same forces, Reinhard Galen and his agents, also created post-war European intelligence, and our Defense Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, covert groupings here and abroad. There are organizations in the United States, such as the NRO, whose very initials are secret. That's National Reconnaissance Organization. It has to do with putting together the different images of the satellite surveillance that goes on. Paranoid. Satellite. And an international fascist network of terror of assassins that were really congealed in a developing underworld of mafia murders and drug trafficking and gun smuggling and political murders worldwide. And these mercenary armies that are used right up to the current day still draw heavily from refugees and refugee populations that are encamped everywhere. They operate under names like Alpha 66 and Omega 7, teams from the Cuban Bay of Pigs, the AAA, and a communist alliance with the DIMA in Chile, the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek, who are some of the major drug dealers in the Golden Triangle, the Somocistas, that are called Contras, and the Honduran border attacks on the Nicaraguan government, the Hmong peoples in Laos that were used and manipulated by the CIA, and reactionary elements from many countries across the world, the Vietnamese, the Laotians, the Falange elements in Lebanon, the Grey Wolves of Turkey. Grey Wolves, a fascist group, included among its membership Mehmet Ali Aga, the attempted assassin of the Pope, a man now falsely accused of working with the Soviet KGB by the right-wing disinformation experts. Interpol was also formed in that period after the war, an international police intelligence agency in collaboration with several Nazi war criminals and our own J. Edgar Hoover, which is our own from the United States. I'm sure you have your own criminals here. These elements then come together internationally under the aegis of new organizational forms in the 1990s, such as the World Union of National Socialists, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, the World Anti-Communist League. I think you get the point. Anti-communism is the main organizing technique and tool for fascism since its inception. Their cover is provided by journalists, so-called, like Claire Sterling or Mount Marvin Cal, who's also himself a member of the Catholic Opus Dei. Their legitimacy and their recruiting is aided by evangelical front operations around the world, such as World Vision, which runs many of the international refugee camps, and includes on its board of directors the president at one time, John W. Inkley Sr. They draw their money from the illegal and very profitable world heroin and cocaine trade. Heroin is worth 10 times gold on the international market, from raw heroin to street level. Cocaine turns a penny, and in fact, currencies at this point are almost worthless. What we're seeing in these scandals is evidence that the real currency internationally is guns for drugs, or perhaps some intermediary product, and sometimes intelligence information, but all of that is worth more than the script that the government's issue. They get training from CIA experts like Mitch Werbel, no longer with us, thankfully, Edwin Wilson, now in prison, Frank Turpel, still not there yet, unreconstructed Nazi torturers who still continue to provide their techniques and the outlines of their work. And the gun smuggling trade, very lucrative, also assisted through these various fronts, and I'll talk a little bit later on about the current one that's in the news. I guess it's in the news up here, BCCI, which is a perfect example of the sort of financial money laundering for the guns and drugs trade. It's only the most recent of these kinds of developments. So this is the real framework, the coalescence of these elements in order to gain back what they didn't win at Stalingrad in 1943 since that period. And this is the real historical framework for the events that happened in my lifetime. I was born in 1947. When I had history in school, I was lucky to get out of the Civil War. By the time we got to high school, I think we finally got up to World War II. But the really important period, 1945, to the current period, was not even discussed, much less covered up. I don't know what young people get now. I understand many high schools in the United States, history is an optional topic. I'm sure democracy will be an optional concept fairly soon. But I found history interesting and went back into it and found a whole other set of connections. And the Cold War led into COINTELPRO and chaos, counterintelligence programs, and chaos with the CIA. COINTELPRO was the FBI, attacks on all domestic attempts to change the social order. It started in the late 40s with the framings of the Rosenbergs as Adam spies and their murder in the electric chair. Ethel Rosenberg said of her execution, this is the first official act of fascism in the United States, at least the most public one. Operation Garden Plot, which was a plan out in California for repression and roundup of anybody protesting the war policies in that period. It went from the McCarthy hearings, just accusing you of being an anti-communist in the 50s, to MKUltra, which you have a little taste of here with Dr. Ewan Cameron, head of both the World and the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and his psychic driving experiments to clear your mind of any memories and thinking, and then punch back in exactly what they wanted to program. But MKUltra wanted to find out if they could do it on the mass level, as well as the individual level, and they spent 30 years before getting close to perfecting it in Jonestown. It's actually the route that leads, I believe, from the Third Reich to the Fourth, which is the one that I think we're currently existing under. And what these Dulles brothers engineered, the massive Cold War lie of two huge nation states that had to exhaust their resources in a constant tension with each other, justified any excess in the direction of lack of civil liberties and toward fascism. And Malcolm X, I believe, was right in the statement he made at the time of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, even though he was censured by the Muslims for saying it. He said the chickens have come home to roost. And I think they are home, even though I think it shouldn't be their home. We shouldn't make such a nice place for them to sit. And what they'd like to bring with them, I think, is a legacy of deception and murder, of war profits and of starvation and eventually of genocide and open dictatorial rule. I think they've compromised the justice system, such as it was. It's already overrun with lawyers, but I think now there's very little hope of getting any sort of a humane decision out of the court. And somebody called the radio station this morning when I was on and started to talk to me about Justice Department intervention, Richard Thornburg, in this case that has to do with Operation Rescue, as they call themselves, going into the abortion clinics. And one of the judges ruled that it was illegal what they were doing, and so the Justice Department is stepping in at this point from the top and arguing the case. And I think that we'll just see more of that. I don't think that people last. The Nazis would go into a town and compromise the judges by having them pick which six people they wanted killed. If they didn't pick six, then the whole town would be killed, said the Nazis, and so they picked six and held mock trials, executed them, and then the judge had that on his or her conscience, and the Nazis could manipulate it to then later pick anyone they wanted to set up and execute. And I think that the idea that we are somehow exempt from this kind of thing within what's supposed to be a democracy is a special brand of American chauvinism, and it blinds us. I think we have to really look at the idea that it can and has happened here. These networks included people like Klaus Barbie, the Nazi butcher Lyon, who was set up and brought here at the end of the war by the 919th Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army and the RAC line. He was only one of hundreds of known criminals that got this special treatment because they knew something or had cut deals before the end of the war. In 1943, Operation Sunrise, Alan Dulles met with SS General Karl Wolff and others in the top command with Reinhard Gehlen and with British intelligence spy master William Stevenson, known as Man Called Intrepid, and made the arrangements to move the Nazi intelligence apparatus here to the United States. And similarly, at the end of the war, special arrangements were made to set up false passports and other things for the Nazis that they wanted to leave in place there or bring them back into another country. And there was one person in relation to the Klaus Barbie situation finally spoke up when the story was about to break. U.S. Army intelligence agent named Erhard Dobringhaus. He teaches out of Wayne State University in Detroit, and he said of the work that he did to cover up Barbie and keep him from being compromised by prosecution for his crimes, he said, "I'm a good American of German extraction, and I did my job." And I think, in fact, what we're being asked to be is good Germans of American or Canadian extraction and expected to do our jobs. Alan Dulles, who collaborated with Gehlen's spies, later headed the Central Intelligence Agency, and later on from that was fired from it by John F. Kennedy, and then came to sit on the Warren Commission investigation, which covered up Dulles' friends who helped kill John F. Kennedy. John J. McCloy was a Rockefeller banker, a high commissioner of Germany after the war, took over the civilian control of the government between Hitler and the next regime, and was instrumental in pardoning key Nazi criminals like Krupp, Hermann Hoppe, Walter Dornberger, Mr. Schock, and others. And his long career made him a godfather in the American establishment. He was at the top of the World Bank. He directed the construction of the Pentagon in 1942-43. He worked with Earl Warren to set up the Japanese concentration camps in the United States. And he refused to allow any military attacks on the Nazi death camps when he was Assistant Secretary of the War during World War II, with the excuse that it would cause retaliation against the Jews. And he stopped even the summary execution of Nazis, which was Winston Churchill's plan initially, in favor of the Nuremberg trials, which he then later thwarted. And he also sat as one of the seven members of the Warren Commission. General Lucius Clay was the military commander of Germany at the end of the war. Clay helped to undermine the prosecution of Nazis like Otto Skorzeny, and later worked with the Nazi generals at Oberammergau in training Eastern European revanchists and Nazis and American GIs in a 5,000-strong special forces group against communism. And this team later moved into the United States and became our Green Berets. Henry Kissinger worked with General Lucius Clay at the Oberammergau training, then went into key stateside Army intelligence and CIA units that were responsible for bringing in these Nazi spies. Kissinger came from Germany to join U.S. Army intelligence during World War II and had as his mentor the mysterious figure Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer. Kramer has a 30-year silent career in the Pentagon Planning Division that includes the prepping not only of Kissinger but also of Alexander Haig. It may also conceal his real identity, prisoner 33 in the dockets at Dachau, and the special lieutenant to Hitler, responsible for the Malmedy massacre, Fritz Kramer. Mr. Kissinger is still relying on his advice and did so while he was Secretary of State, and this individual Kramer also worked very closely with Daniel Graham in the High Frontiers organization in Washington, D.C. to promote the Star Wars technology of death. C.D. Jackson, from the Loose Empire, a publishing company, joined Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon in a scheme to bring the Belarusian government into the United States. Life magazine, put out by Loose, had him as its editor at the time when they published the doctored photos of Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle and a pistol. And both Time and Life were responsible for much of the Cold War propaganda that allowed the national security state to flourish and the Pentagon to grow. Richard Milhouse Nixon, former president, who was with Navy intelligence at the end of World War II, had worked with the Navy after the war that included importing Nazi war criminals up through the Jay Gould family estate in Long Island. Among those was Nikolai Malaksa, who collaborated with Hermann Göring. This was apparently no problem for Nixon. He defended Malaksa's U.S. citizenship and even got his friend Pat McCarran to introduce a special bill in Congress to get citizenship for him and other Nazis. And McCarran and Senator Joe McCarthy were the two that later introduced legislation to set up detention and internment camps in the United States for times of war, national emergency, and internal security. Those laws still exist on the books, and people can be identified as possibly committing any act of espionage or sabotage, or even thinking about possibly committing that, and can be locked up without writ of habeas corpus or appearance before judge or jury for the duration of the emergency. And there are other people who figure into that period in terms of bringing these people in. I wanted to just point at some of the more central ones and give you an idea of the organizations. Frank Wisner was an OSS official and a CIA veteran who brought the Latvian Thunder Cross, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, these fascist groups, the Romanian Iron Guard, among others. About 5,000 Nazis came to work at Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, the Defense Language Institute in the United States. And Alan Dulles said of Reinhard Gehlen after the war, "He's on our side now." And Bobby Inman, in response to a question I asked him, he was director of National Security Agency and the CIA networks at different points, and he admitted to me that these fascists were the bedrock of the covert operations in Europe in the 1940s and 50s by our CIA, and they molded the anti-communist policy in the United States. J. Peter Grace is another central figure. The Grace fortunes came originally actually from bird droppings that his grandfather had a little island off Jamaica, but he was able to build that into an international shipping cartel. And for 30 years, his company employed Otto Ambrose, a Nazi war criminal from IG Farben, and the Nazi drug cartel, and Ambrose was a chemist who developed Zyklon B for the fascists, the actual gas that was used to kill the Jews and the others in the chambers, this cyanide gas. And the German steel group, Flick, has extensive Nazi ties in the past, and there were scandals within the recent years about their financial operations and their controlling stock interest in the Grace family company. It was J. Peter Grace, who was instrumental also in forming the AIFLD, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, which was essentially a CIA front internationally that played a role in the Kissinger plan to overthrow Allende in Chile and to compromise labor movements around the world. And it was also Kissinger, following the situation in Chile where he helped the CIA engineer a coup there, who sent Mr. Rauch, a Nazi from the State Department, to advise the Chilean secret police. Ralph had been in charge of the mobile ovens that were used to kill gypsies and Jews during the war, homosexuals and political dissidents for the Nazis. And these same forces were also involved later in political assassinations around the world and in the United States. Another key person is Helena von Dahm. She was personal White House appointment secretary and a longtime personal secretary to Ronald Reagan. And she was appointed as ambassador to Vienna at the time when Kurt Waldheim was coming in order to help him, I believe, cover up his Nazi past and do his PR work. She came to the United States in the 1950s and worked closely with Albrecht Otto von Bolschwing, who had worked as a translator for him in Vienna for his corporation. And von Bolschwing was the one who gave the direct orders to Adolf Eichmann in the Einsatzgruppe of the SS. And Helena's husband, Christian von Dahm, ran the Bank of America chapter in La Paz, Bolivia, which defaulted on huge loans and had to do with the international drug trafficking. There are other people in the scenario that that played key roles. General Douglas MacArthur and General Patton both helped elements of the Nazi general staff and other Nazi intelligence agents move into the United States, and credited them with helping to write an official history of World War II at the end of the war. And there were people within the Vatican circles, for instance, Monsignor Montini, who was an OSS operative in Southeast Asia at the end of World War II, and later became Pope Paul VI. And he used Caritas Internationalis, a welfare organization of the church, to give refugee travel documents to Nazis like Hans Heppelmann and Martin Bormann to help them move. Pope John Paul II, the current pope, actually worked for IG Farben at Auschwitz under their Solvay drug subsidiary, a rubber plant that was run by the Nazi financier Hermann Hoppe. And Farben employed Fritz Kramer and had at that point 750 subsidiaries worldwide, including firms in the United States. And in the recent Vatican Bank scandals, this Pope appointed a four-man committee to study and clean up the Vatican finances, and it included his old boss and Hitler's personal banker, Hermann Hoppe.